Hi, and welcome to this transmission from Cybershow Radio, presented today by me, Andy Farnell. Today we're talking about what is disappearing and what is appearing in its place. You know, when we started to imagine the Cybershow, our very first take on it was as a live streaming, magazine-style programme with lots of smaller bits and features. Over the past year, we've gravitated more towards long-form episodes. Part of the reason for that is that we felt the need to more properly research topics for the show. It's our show, and we control the timings and the agenda, so why not try to do a good and thorough job of it, to make the kind of show that we'd actually like to listen to ourselves? Because to become just another voice in the echo chamber of media rumour and hot takes is really to become part of the problem rather than the solution to the issues that we want to address. Of course, we still keep the live discussion segments. Everyone likes the irreverent banter and jibber-jabber. And, good news, we've got more completely live format shows coming down the pipeline. Often, though, we get into subjects that are ongoing, like the British Post Office and Fujitsu scandal covered in the last episode. That's not going away. So expect to hear updates on that, and other emerging life-ruining IT scandals from the same shower that brought you this spectacular shit show, such as the alleged massive corruption of the UK's immigration and pension databases. More on that another time. So today, we don't have a single theme. Instead, it's time for a low-quality Tesco value episode of The Cybershow, made from delicious, meatish chunklets swept from the cutting room floor and cobbled together into a kind of Donna cyber kebab. We've decided to call this episode Disappearing Acts, because it's about the things that are going and the things that are appearing in their place. Amongst other things, we'll be looking at the disappearance of reliable communications, signalling problems, the disappearance of people, the disappearance of money, and the disappearance of trust. But first, here's a word from our sponsors.
Sponsored by Boudica Cybersecurity, maintaining digital realms.
This girl won't love you. She'll never even look at you. You don't stand a chance because you're no good. You don't have what you need to have. And for this, you suffer. Because you haven't bought our product. You just cannot ever be happy unless you buy it right now and become better. Advance to popularity. All from the comfort of your armchair. So attractive, so sublime, so subscribe. Subscribe and rate higher on our Gullible Index. With a high Gullible rating, we can sell on your personal details at a premium to other advertisers.
I'm so happy since I bought this.
Buy and subscribe today.
About a year ago, Ed and I were making an on-the-go episode when we found ourselves stranded somewhere in the New Forest with all of the trains cancelled and a very long walk home in front of us. At the same time, the mobile phone signal seemed to be fading. And I was telling Ed how we're actually getting rid of our landline at home, and it worried me that I might not be able to make reliable emergency calls if I had to. We ended up talking about how communications technology, although in many ways it's massively improved in terms of bandwidth and connectivity, has become less reliable over time. That the switch to digital systems has left us with kind of patchy and often completely absent connectivity. And that the whole thing seems very precarious, with lots of conspicuous outages and major failures that seem to leave society scrambling for what to do. So here's a couple of segments on the problem of disappearing reliable communication technologies.
You're listening to The Cybershow.
Ed and I are talking about signalling problems. Now, we live in a country which has, I suppose, to be as polite as possible, the most piss-poor public transport system imaginable.
Yeah.
But the main excuse for everything that goes wrong is signalling problems, isn't it? Whenever something goes wrong, it's signalling problems.
Signalling problems.
What on earth do you think is going on with that, then? I mean, why can't we, in 2023, having had Shannon and Morse, and basically put down the fundamentals of communications theory, like in the 1920s, why can we still not get bits from A to B in England?
Old equipment, probably.
I'm going to take you up on that and say no. New equipment, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, it's...
If it was old equipment, then it would still
be working, yeah. That's usually the issue, isn't it? Just equipment that hasn't been implemented properly, and just the people that installed it haven't really set it up correctly. Or the equipment itself is crap, and someone's already signed the contract. So it's like, oh, bugger, we'll have to use it.
I suspect it's over-complex, badly configured, badly maintained, and badly managed. I expect there's a lot of sort of layer 8 problems of people who really don't know what they're doing. Trying desperately to manage a complex public transport signalling system, and also hamstrung by red tape and fear, because if anything goes wrong and people die, then they'll say, well, we always put safety first.
Yeah.
Perfectly safe train system is one that never runs.
Exactly, yeah. There's risk associated with anything, really. But you can't use that as an excuse for, well, you say that, it's not running anyway today, so it is safe, because I'm not on it, and no one else is. So in that way, yes, they've got 100% safety record today, because there are no train services.
So you could theoretically have some scalable safety. You could start running the trains at 20 miles an hour, and it would still be better to get home, albeit very, very slowly, but with almost certain safety. It's almost like the systems are designed to run at maximum, optimum capacity, or not to run at all.
Yeah, because, you know, that. Yeah, okay, if there's signalling problems, the driver's got eyes, and they've got a brake, and they've got radios, and, you know, most of them are very experienced drivers. I'm sure they can stop a train at 20 miles an hour in a few seconds if they need to, but... Yeah, I think it's underlying protocol that's not going to allow the common sense things to take place.
Common sense never prevails wherever modern systems exist, does it? It's, it's like they're designed to eliminate any kind of human fallback at all. That's very worrying, because I think it not only does it mean that when they either work or they don't, but when they break, then they break absolutely catastrophically.
Yeah. There seems to be no in-between. It's chaos or... working. There's no compromise there. It's like, all it would take is a manager to make a decision to run the trains at half speed, or...
But nobody will make that decision. No. Nobody ever has the courage.
No, because they have to sign a piece of paper, and then if anything goes wrong, they've got lives on their line, so...
Well, is that how it works? I mean...
Well, at 20 miles an hour, I don't think anyone's getting killed. Worst case scenario. No, I think it's just a case of... policies that have not been thought through by correct groups of people.
They've never been thought through. Policy's a really interesting word. It's not the same word as strategy. It's not the same word as design. It's not the same word as all of the things that we associate with complex systems. Policies very often are things that are tacked on at the political level. And so I think we confuse policies for rationally considered engineering-like design.
Yeah.
And they're absolutely not. They're all like a mishmash of sticking plasters and personal gripes and bugbears and things that serve people expediently in the moment. They're absolutely the realm of politics.
Yeah.
And so therefore, when someone says to you, well, this is our policy, that could mean anything. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a policy that's written down, does it?
Yeah, it's because it can be used as a get-out-of-jail-free card by an otherwise competent employee. Oh, sorry, but policy says.
Another thing that goes hideously wrong with British public transport systems is information, which is kind of a form of signalling, isn't it?
Yeah.
Some of the guys who work on the platform safety officers.
Yeah.
I chat to them quite a lot because they're always really on the level. Really nice guys and girls. And they all carry their smartphones around, and they all have this app, I've forgotten what it's called. He said, this is the one, because it actually plugs into the telemetry, the sensors on the network, and it's completely independent from the South West Trains and the Network Rail.
The
official ones. No, it's not.
No.
It's another one that's independent. And for some reason, I mean, obviously because the APIs must be public. And
they
must be that they're forced to be public.
Yeah.
So it taps into this. He says, this is super reliable. You can literally see where there is a train. And if it's past a certain station, there's the red dot that tells you. And often, the information that's up on the display boards, the official information, is completely inaccurate.
Yeah.
And he tells the passengers, don't trust that. Don't listen to that, not even for a moment.
Yeah.
Let me look it up on this app.
It's done by someone in an office who's like been told that there's problems, and they'll just go in and put that on the board.
There's multiple sources of information and multiple communication paths, and some of them are wrong, some of them are deliberately misleading.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it depends on who you ask at what time of the day and so on. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's just that thing of like miscommunicating and stressing all the passengers out as well. And they're like, well, what's the correct information? What do I rely upon? You know, all these, the same, there's only one system.
Yeah.
And yet you've got three different data sets of information.
And that poverty of information and that conflict of it, I've seen really putting the health and safety at risk. So at Southampton, you'll get an entire train full of people suddenly at the very last minute realise that the train is going from the and they all run up the stairs, run down the stairs, there's suitcases smashing, people falling over, holding the doors open, trying to get into the train because the information came with 30 seconds to spare.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Complete failure of info systems.
Mm.
Why do we have this total failure of information systems in 2023?
It's not about transition of data, it's about complication of the data and the, you know, many ways it's interpreted by different apps in this case. They all have the same signalling data, so why is one showing that the train's not coming and why is one saying the train's 5 minutes away?
Yeah.
And then you're left thinking, well, what's the correct information? What do I rely upon here? We had this situation about the platform. There was a platform change for the Bournemouth train from Southampton Central. The train will now depart from platform 2B. So there's no way that can depart from 2B.
There isn't a platform 2B.
But there is one.
Okay.
But it's on a... there's a line that changes at Southampton where it forks into four from the both ends. And the way that the train was coming, I thought, there's no reason that should happen because there's no other train scheduled to go down three. Everyone was panicking going over to two. I just thought, I'll wait 5 minutes. Platform has now changed back to platform three. I thought, yeah, there we go. It's just information overload.
It's information chaos. And it's gratuitous as well. So well, here's a couple of tricks I've noticed. One is that they will always put a sunny and optimistic disposition on the information that they're giving. So there's a train that's going to be half an hour late. Let's say that the train is due at 17:30. And at 17:29, there'll be an announcement that says, we're very sorry to announce that the 17:30 is delayed by 1 minute.
Yeah.
And it will, and its expected arrival time will go up to 17:31. And then a minute later, they say, we're very sorry to announce that it's gone up to 17:33 or something.
Yeah.
And what will happen is every time you approach the time that it's now supposed to be, they'll add on a little bit more.
Yeah.
So there's always this hope held out, this optimism that maybe your train's going to be there in 3 minutes. But what actually happens is, you know, and they've known for all that time that it's going to be an hour.
Yeah.
So it kind of works, I think, like those very badly written, remember in Windows, you'd have like a download bar and it would like shoot up to like, you know, 99% or something immediately and then stay there for an hour on 99%. The sliding window average or whatever's being used to create the expected arrival time is some naive algorithm.
It's just someone's come up with it and it's like, yeah, that works.
Yeah.
That'll do. We won't bother changing it.
And once it's read out on the voice announcement, it kind of attains a gravitas and authority that people believe in it. I heard the lady, she said, you know, it's going to be here at 17:31.
In a very serious voice.
And that will be interdispersed with completely gratuitous and pointless things. Like, if you see anything suspicious, if you see anything that doesn't look right, and threatening kind of pseudo-announcements.
Yeah.
I'd be there at 11:30 at night and there would be nobody on the station.
Mm.
And an announcement would come on and say, security personnel patrol our stations 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
Like, really? I don't see any.
Mm.
Yeah, I haven't seen any for
cameras.
For 3 hours. Yeah.
There's the personnel looking through a camera.
Yeah. Mind the gap.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, wait, fuck, yeah, mind the gap.
Yeah.
And then I guess somebody thought that that was just a little bit...
Yeah, now it's please mind the gap between the train and the platform edge.
Well, it went up in stages. I mean, then they added please. It was meant to please mind the gap.
Yeah.
And they kind of toned it down a little bit. And then there was obviously some confusion about, like, the gap between... What, you know, what gap? The gap between the train and the sky? I don't know. And then for some reason, this is the one that just blew me away. They just added the word edge onto the end.
Yeah.
Like, what was the confusion there between the train and some other part of the platform?
Yeah. No, I think it's more of a... When you look at the American language, we call a pavement, they call it a sidewalk. They describe exactly what it is. Glasses, eyeglasses. You're like, well, it's not going to be, you're not going to put these on your eyes, are you?
Yeah.
These like pint glasses, you're not going to hold that up to your eye.
So you think it's disambiguation?
I think so, yeah. There's a level of that, and I think that people are just assuming that everyone's idiots.
But the upshot is that travelling by train in Britain is just the unpleasant experience, because you're sitting on the train and there's just announcement after announcement after announcement after announcement. And they were all incorrect, or factually or useless.
Yeah.
Either useless information or actually misleading information.
Yeah.
So there's something up about the way that the information age has gone wrong. It really has gone wrong, because in a way, if I were able to go back in a time machine to the 1970s, when none of that existed, the train still kind of had more or less the same service. They would be late sometimes, they would turn up sometimes, get on, and but generally it would be a more pleasant journey, I think. It'd probably be a bit slower. And every now and again there'd be a horrendous train crash and 400 people would die. Kind of bracketing that bit out, you know, not much was different, but it didn't need that broken information system.
Yeah, and I think it's just sort of over-informing people, isn't it? And then they just don't know what to do anymore. They're like, I've got so much information. I'm not going to process any of it.
Yeah.
So it goes, what they're thinking is constructive is the complete opposite.
Yeah, I
don't know. I still think someone needs to kind of tap someone on the shoulder of like one of these train companies and say, you do know that nobody listens to these announcements, because
I'm sure they know that.
They must know that, but they probably just don't care. They think we've done our duty, we've given them the information.
Duty? Is it a duty? I mean, this is what I'm trying to trace. Like, where did it come from? What the hell are they thinking?
I think it's kind of gone from, I think it's over safety in their eyes, in some way. It's like we have to give them every single ounce of information so that they can make their own informed decisions.
That's an interesting hypothesis. So just say that again. If we give people
all of the possible,
every possible piece of information that there is,
then they can make their own informed decisions from that.
Informed decisions.
Because they've been informed by the amount of data, technically anyway, but as a human point of view.
Yeah.
If you've been given all this information, it's more than like, you know, the train's going to be delayed by X amount. Mm. And then it's 5 minutes, 7 minutes, 9 minutes. Oh, it's cancelled. And then you think,
all it does is lead to madness and frustration and gaslighting.
Yeah.
Well, it is gaslighting. I think that's what's going on. Yeah.
Many workers of McDonald's say that when they go home, they can still hear all the fryers going beep, 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 when they're trying to sleep, and it's just a noise that's sort of ingrained into their head.
Wow, it's almost like an industrial injury.
It's almost like they might as well just have one next to their bed whilst they're trying to sleep, and it would sound exactly the same. It's damaging in both ways. People will completely block it out, or it will become so intrusive that you'll want to do everything to ignore it anyway.
Yeah.
And try and block it out. So either way, when you overdo it with sound, people are going to try and avoid it and ignore it as much as they can.
And they'll put up their own defences to it, whatever those are, like turning it off.
Yeah.
A lot of warning systems don't work because people turn them off because they're annoying.
Yeah. Otherwise, if we took every single bit of information in, it's a natural protecting mechanism from our brains to try and stop the information overload, otherwise you'd all go mad, especially in this modern day where, you know, you've got technology everywhere and
it's a kind of information warfare, and it happens, and your phone is a battleground for it. It's clear, I can clearly see even people who switch notifications off struggle with their phone pushing stuff at them.
There are people behind those decisions as well that equally have got the same similar brains, and they know exactly what damage it's doing, which is why the big tech leaders' children get put into tech-free schools.
I was just thinking that. Yeah, I mean, they
know exactly what the poison
too,
is.
And you look at their behaviour, they do everything that they can to exclude them. I mean, I'm a case in point, aren't I? I'm a computer scientist who doesn't own a smartphone.
Yeah.
But I know that CEOs of big techs won't even let their kids go to schools where they have tablets.
Where they have a computer screen.
They just want them to have a much better lifestyle, a much better educational experience. But the average people don't know that Bill Gates or Zuckerberg wouldn't let their kids go near Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, even you saying that you don't have a smartphone, you're in the 2% in this country.
What?
In 2023, that's mad.
Yeah, but I still think in 2023 that you'd have to be clinically insane to have one. Yeah. I mean, I know you have one, so I don't mean to sort of like... You're heavily modded, you're in control of
yours. I've sort of made a in-between compromise somewhere where I've got an open source operating system, and I've removed as much stuff as I can, but of course the hardware's still owned by Google.
Yep.
So there's only so much you can do.
You're listening to The Cyber Show.
This episode of The Cyber Show is kindly sponsored by Boudica Cybersecurity.
There was an article I saw the other day about a new shop that's opened in London, Tesco or something like that, or maybe an M&S. The only way to get in is by scanning a barcode on your smartphone, and they sort of use cameras to detect what you picked off the shelves, and then you just walk out the shop and it charges you. But then you've just alienated anyone who doesn't have a smartphone. But they're thinking,
but they don't give a fuck, because that's like 2% of people.
But that's just one shop of many that are going to follow suit, because 98%+ of people have got a smartphone.
But then,
so what happens when
by contrast,
there's no
like my local neighbourhood was a Sobo thing, where all of the shops have agreed that they will and they will take cash. And it's like they have all the posters up, you know, cash is a right, this and all that kind of stuff. So that the word that I used in Digital Vegan was foisting. I like that word. It's kind of, it's not quite violently forcing something on somebody.
Yeah.
It's not quite like holding them down and opening their mouth and making them, you know.
Yeah.
But it's almost that. It's one step short of a violent imposition. And I think that that's where the technology industry's got to. It can't. It can only really function if it's able to, because it overproduces.
I think the problem we've got with these shops is, you know, everyone's thinking, oh, this is amazing, and there's no pushback. And to an average person who's already got a smartphone, the convenience of it was like, what are the negatives? And there's no, you'd be crazy for saying that was a bad idea to most of the population.
Don't need much thought to consider any number of bad outcomes from that, which are, I mean, just employment. I mean, people need jobs, right?
And
when you go to Tesco's and you ask the people who work in my local Tesco, do you like, they love it. They actually like being part of their community. They're all from the local community. And they want the money. They want the job. And they don't mind that it's a job in Tesco's. And they absolutely hate those bloody automatic checkout, because they never work. They're always broken. There's always something that they don't get right, you know, something needs approval or won't scan the barcode. I mean, the technology's substandard.
I mean, ask anyone in retail that has to deal with self-service machines. They hate them.
I mean, if you just get down to the most basic practical level of what is the real experience of ordinary human beings, anyone who's got their feet on the ground and an ounce of common sense will tell you, like, here's 10 knockdown arguments about why this is a shit idea. So who are these mythical people? Because they always get brought up in these arguments. Oh, well, everyone will tell you this is amazing. I don't think that they really do. I think that those people are taken along with the argument. They don't want to admit their own reservations and scepticism. They're embarrassed and afraid. They want to appear terribly modern and progressive. And isn't it wonderful that we've got these shops now where you just need to think about what you need to buy,
and then it just comes
falls
into,
from the sky into your open mouth.
And convenient, I think, are the two really, really dangerous words to use.
I'm talking with George. George is a cybersecurity expert, but he also happens to have a regular job. He works in a Tesco store. George has to deal with automatic checkouts.
Yes, so self-service, we call them.
Call them self-service checkouts. Ed and I were talking about new supermarket stores where the only way you can get in is with a smartphone. And you go around and you just put things in your basket, and when you're finished with it, you just walk out of the store and it figures out what you've got. The idea of having a completely self-service technology where you have to have a smartphone, I presume, but maybe there's other technologies. Is that a good idea? What do you think of it? What's your experience, George?
Well, I mean, if you look at the sense of self-service, they're an absolute nightmare. Most people don't like them. If you're a sort of person that's looking just to do basic sales, you know, you want to be in and out quick, then they're brilliant, you know. But people who do their big shots, I spend more time approving alcohol, sorting out the scales, because the scales haven't registered the weight and it's waiting for me to approve it. It ends up being more stress than it is than it probably is to be on a simple man checkout. I mean, my opinion of them is that, you know, at the moment there's current talks of other big stores sort of just going over to just self-service. You know, it takes away a certain aspect of personality, you know. Otherwise we're in a world of just being, you know, people that don't really talk to anyone, you know. We just on our own entirely, you know, not involved.
And some of the arguments that have been put forth in support of entirely automated stores is that a lot of people have social anxiety these days and they just don't like to interact with other people. Personally, that makes me feel very sad. But do you think
that that's correct, that that's an increasing thing? Or do you think that actually people like to see a face in a store?
I mean, going by my personal opinion, I prefer to see a person. But the other thing as well is that, you know, is that helping the situation? If you've got social anxiety and you end up going through self-service, is that going to help the situation? Because I don't think it does.
That's a very good point.
You know, at the end of the day, you spend, you know, if you're not going to talk to anyone and stuff, it's just going to get worse. You know, it's forcing yourself to be able to talk to somebody and have a conversation that stops the social anxiety getting so bad.
So it's kind of reinforcing the problem.
It is, if you think about it. And if we go back to what you mentioned earlier about the smartphones in the stores and stuff, you're then taking power away from certain people. Not everyone's got a smartphone. My grandparents got a smartphone, but not that they know how to work it. So what, they can't shop there because they don't know how to work it?
I think that's the plan. I mean, I think Ed mentioned that there was a survey done recently that claimed, although I'm sceptical, that 98% of people have smartphones now. And it's very easy to simply dismiss the other 2% and make them marginalised and socially exclude them. So my fear as a non-smartphone-owning person, out of choice, is that that kind of retail will simply be inaccessible to me.
Yeah, and that's a breach of rights. You know, everyone should have an equal opportunity to be able to go to a shop, buy what they want and leave. You know, they haven't really thought it through, I don't think, personally.
Well, the shops would say, well, you do have a choice. You have a choice to not shop here because you haven't got a smartphone. But I think what they're missing is that those supermarkets, by their efficiency, will then edge out all of the other retailers on the high street.
Yeah, absolutely. I understand what the saving benefits are, but it's the same as like when we went to the traditional high street to the supermarkets of today. That's completely replaced the normal butchers, fishmongers, all that sort of stuff is long gone because it's just too efficient and it's sad.
Do you think that maybe one of the downsides of this is theft? I mean, I know there's a certain amount of what's it called, wastage, and that supermarkets anticipate that some shoplifters will pocket things and so on. There's only so much that the guards can do. But don't self-service checkouts kind of increase that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's loads of stealing going on in there because they'll either keep it in their pockets and stuff. And because I'm watching everyone, there's normally, for me, in my example, there are 6 self-checkout machines.
Yeah.
I've got to keep an eye on everybody. I can't see everybody that's got something in their pocket. And all they have to do is not put it on the scale and it just lets them through.
Yep.
You know, because if I haven't seen it, that's it. You know, and that's one of the reasons why prices are probably so high is because they have to account for stealing.
And is that more difficult when you're faced with an actual cashier?
Well, the thing is with, at least with a cashier, then you've got their full attention on you. They're going to be able to see things.
Yeah.
You know, okay, it's not going to see everything, but I would, from my opinion, think that there's less chance because they've got your attention. It's not so much as you're watching loads of people. You're only focused on the one customer because you're providing the customer service.
The arguments for completely automated technological society of getting rid of expensive employees because they're human and they're messy and they might go on maternity leave or get sick and so on. Let me put it very simply. Do you like your job? Because many people say, well, I don't want to have a crappy job in Tesco. And I've worked in retail, I've worked in bars, I've worked in a greengrocer's shop and things like that. Even though I'm a computer scientist, I can command a great wage. And I look back on those times in my life and I actually really enjoyed. You come across as quite a personable, maybe even gregarious person at times. So do you actually like your job and like interacting with people?
I mean, it's an interesting question. There's a bit of both sides, to be brutally honest. You know, I love people, so any interaction with people, but unfortunately on self-service, because they're all sort of just want to get out and go, you don't get much interaction. But when I get to do things like customer service or anything else that involves me working with customers, I love that. But on the caveat of that, the other side, for me personally, is that I like to, you know, I like to feel like I'm challenged, and in that sort of job you're not. You know, you're just there just to approve alcohol or, you know, put people through and things like that. They're really basic stuff. You
become a flesh machine, a human machine.
You do. And, you know, I'd like to think that I'm actually doing something, you know, changing something. Because obviously, no matter what you do in any supermarket, no matter how good you are at your job, there's still, you know, every week there's still going to be the same amount of people coming in or maybe more. There'll always be a need for it. You see, you know, you're not solving anything. You're just sort of almost feeding it in a sense.
Right. Last question then. So are AIs and machines going to take over the world and put us all out of work? Or will there still be jobs for people at Tesco's and for people like me who like to go and talk to someone at Tesco's, I'll still be able to go and buy my stuff.
I think AI, you know, is a big thing, and I think it's really interesting, but I can't personally see it changing everything, because no matter how much you advance and no matter how much power or program you put into it, at the end of the day, it is a machine. It is a very basic, follows a set of procedures. The human mind is able to go at different angles, able to move things around, manipulate situations in a way that I don't think any automated system could ever would. You know, think of the telephone automated system that, you know, half the time it doesn't solve the issue, you know, so you end up talking to a real person.
I'll still be able to go in and talk to someone at
absolutely
Tesco's.
Certainly at the moment, absolutely, and I can't see it completely. I can see part of it taking over, but I can't imagine it ever taking completely over.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, George.
Oh, and, my pleasure.
Thanks for being on The Cyber Show.
Thank you.
So there we go, both Ed and George talking about the disappearance of reliable information and the disappearance of people with whom we can interact, each brought about by the ever-increasing presence of digital technology in our lives. Now, we also touched there on the disappearance of money. And that's something that Helen and I were talking about quite recently.
Yeah, Craig told me this story now.
Right.
But it was about a massive hullabaloo in Portsmouth at the coffee shop that was ostensibly all about transgenderism.
Oh.
Was it at the Costa?
Yeah, maybe. I didn't hear about this. This is
somebody called someone and said you're transphobic. Someone else said,
oh,
and it was one of those.
Yeah, you know? Right. But you're the
and
same
so the
thing.
Story went got wings and it went all there. But I mean, my point was is that this argument wasn't about any of that.
Right.
It had started because one of the people wanted to pay cash.
Oh.
And that just got airbrushed out of the whole story.
Right.
And to me, like, that was the story.
Yeah. How did an argument arise from him not using a card or her not using a card?
Well, I mean, they frequently do more and more these days, right? Because people want to pay cash.
Right.
And they have a right to pay cash,
yeah,
and cash is good. Money makes the world go round.
Yeah, and it helps,
but, you know,
homeless people.
The cashless society is a menace.
Yeah, homeless people are coming up to you now and going, have you got any spare change? You're like, no, I've only got my card. And they're like, can I walk you to the cash point? And everyone's like, but you might rob me. What if you pull out a knife when I'm getting my money and put my card in? So it's causing problems.
The disappearance of cash is a very, very grave danger.
Did I tell you that I found some guy selling NOS? You know, kind of, you know, frowned upon, not quite illegal. It kind of is, because they're, you know, not paying taxes or whatever, but they were using Google Pay. So I did a little social engineering, asked him a load of questions, you know, made a little purchase on some weird balloon, gave it to some other guy.
Right.
Just to see if it was a business registration or his personal account. So this guy is paying 30 quid for a NOS thing. He gets over 300 quid for it, and it puts it all through his actual bank account in England via Google Pay, and no one's bloody questioned it. He does that every single day of the week. He's making thousands and fucking pounds a year. Going through Google and his bank, no one's questioned it. And yet that, I've already spoken to a finance team and gone, how is that possible? Shouldn't be. Your bank is supposed to investigate that. And this guy's been doing it for years, he said. Absolutely years. Personal accounts, his own name. And he's just given his name to all these people.
Right.
Left, right and centre. It's so dangerous. I want to investigate this. We've now got these 24-hour metro banks. They do drive-through banking. So you can make a 3 a.m. deposit. I reckon we should do some investigative work where we go and we rent a little apartment across the road from one of these over the weekend, and we see who tops in and what kind of cars drive in and what age groups are driving in and depositing or withdrawing money at 3 a.m.
Cash money.
Money, yeah, cash. They can deposit any cash and it goes to worldwide banking. So yeah. Basically money laundering, because they could deposit it to their offshore account from their Google Pay, so they can go there, do their transaction. Why are these all springing up? Why have we got 24-hour cash banks now? How are people getting away with using Google Pay? Because he said to me as well, I said, do you sell anything else? And he went, oh, sometimes sell a bit of weed, but we know people who like sell really hardcore drugs using Google Pay. And it's like, so you're telling me that there are smackheads, you know, smack dealers, huge, great big smack dealers that make millions of pounds a year walking around just using Google Pay in their bank, and no one's fucking questioned why £6 million has left their bank account this year.
One of the very strong arguments for the cashless society, or for really strong visibility.
It's to prevent that sort of thing.
It's to stop money laundering.
But it's
and
yet
the
better.
Bank, well, I mean, what happened with it? Was it HSBC? I mean,
right.
It turns out that the banks are up to their necks. They're absolutely complicit in money laundering,
right.
And always have been.
And they clearly are. And Google and PayPal. Yep. He said he uses Google and PayPal and Apple Pay, and no one gives a shit. And when speaking to people who are really high up in finance, they're like, oh no, Google and Apple Pay have promised us that they do that.
Why make such a specious argument that's about we're going to be able to track the money flows of the rich and powerful. No, that's not going to happen.
Bad man is what
it's
they want.
It's going to be legibility of everybody's pint and cigarette and everybody's packet of crisps that they buy.
So they can reduce the benefits down because everyone's buying fags with it. That's what they'll claim.
Chinese style, cybernetic social algorithms, exactly.
Oh, they're not poor. They haven't got problems with food. They've all got a TV and a computer in their house. Yeah. Well, they have to have a computer or their children can't do homework, but we won't go there.
So I just can't buy the argument about money laundering being any kind of a genuine reason for pushing a cashless society.
And that him using that Google Pay and doing that every single day, making hundreds of pounds and not having it questioned, is a very, very clear example of exactly what is wrong. We go cashless, how are you going to chase it? It's meant to help, but actually it's just going to make it easier because you've got to go to Google and go, hi, because I guess you have to work with them because they're the facilitator. Mm. So if the bank want to investigate it, they're going to have to say, Google, can I have your account details for X user, please? They don't have the right to do that. And it might be very complex, the data you get back from them. So the bank might not be able to actually read it and understand it.
Yeah.
That creates a big problem. Maybe it's a skills gap.
Well, definitely. Let's explore that one. Let's explore the
cashless society issue.
Ed and I had a different take on it. And this is where I come from. You know, I did that interview with what's the White Lantern guys. The Cat Cashtastrophe.
Right, yeah.
And I was coming at it from a resilience point of view. Like cash is a lubricant in society, but it's also a buffer, like a big capacitor. It stores portable wealth.
Yeah, so it's that like a grain store.
Yeah, when the internet goes off, people aren't shooting each other over a loaf of bread 2 days later.
No.
Because they've got ability to trade. It's actually a peacekeeping tool.
Is it back to that bread and circus thing again, isn't it? We're going back to that bread and circus. The internet is considered, in a way, it's circus for a few days, like you just said.
Oh, I see.
We lose our circus, but after 3 weeks of not having internet, we start to lose our bread and our circus.
That is really interesting, because what you came up with then is you thought that things were all going to go pear-shaped because people were bored and they're not on their Xboxes anymore. And I'm thinking from
three
a slightly
weeks
more
later, though, the food stocks go down.
Much quicker than that. Much quicker.
Because of the 3 weeks later, we are hungry.
Just-in-time supply chains are really, really fragile.
They're completely digitalized.
You switch off all of the digital communications and there will be no food very quickly.
Yeah, but if the internet goes off for 2 days, people whinge because they can't get their Netflix or whatever. But a week in, people will be whinging because Nan's starving to death now in the corner. Mm-hmm. And there's no water or heating for a week. And
That's a different order of ugly.
Yeah, yeah.
The army can only hand out food for so long.
Exactly. Which is why I've got cupboards full of out-of-date food that you can eat forever.
So far today we've been talking about disappearing things, disappearing people, disappearing money, disappearing communication channels. Technology is taking away a lot of things and we're not sure what it's replacing them with. One of the things that's disappearing in society is trust. What do you think about the idea of disappearing trust?
Disappearing trust leads on an individual level to insecurity, but on a social level it might lead to social breakdown. So for example, hypothetically, if a government is no longer trustworthy, can no longer earn because trust can't be compelled, if a government can no longer earn the trust of its people, it no longer has any legitimate power or authority, and a government will need legitimate power and authority to do the things that we need them to do good things. You know, for example, such as to run the NHS.
All good societies are high trust societies. They have a high GDP, good economics, good health, things like that. So society runs on trust.
Yeah. For example, why would you pay tax in situations where there's no trust? You might be compelled to pay tax, you might pay tax under duress, but you don't have that sense of, I'm willing to pay this because I know that this funds good school, good education, good road networks, good transport, etc.
I think in Britain we've come from a tradition where we're kind of happy to pay tax because we've always had a benevolent view of government, whereas Americans kind of have a very mistrustful, they don't like paying taxes. I mean, no one likes paying taxes, but you can like paying taxes a bit more, can't you? Okay, so I want to talk now about what's making trust disappear. Tell us about the NSA definition of trust.
Trust is the ability to do harm. But that is a double-edged sword, because actually without the ability to do harm, there can also be no good either. So, for example, a brain surgeon has got the opportunity to do enormous harm. Trust is the ability to do harm, but we allow people the possibility of doing enormous harm in the hope that actually they will use that opportunity to do something in our interests.
Like trusting a surgeon.
Yeah.
There's a concept of zero trust which is appearing more and more in technology.
Mm. Zero trust is a uniform system that involves taking no risks, actually, not allowing any possibility of deviation from a certain process or protocol in order to establish trust.
What happens when that's going on?
It puts enormous power in the hands of the systems that are there to establish trust. And that power can be absolutely misused. It can be used to exclude people who should be included, and it can also include people who should be excluded. So in the recent surveillance state documentary made about state surveillance in China, one Chinese dissident, there was a scene where her COVID pass that was on her smartphone was questioned and she was marked as being unable to travel.
So the trust actually moves from the principles, from the agents at the end, into the technology and the systems. You're not getting rid of trust in zero trust, you're simply moving it. And you're putting it into systems which have powerful actors controlling them.
Mm.
So it's a kind of a land grab on trust in a way.
Yeah. Also, I think that people place enormous misplaced trust in systems that we think are there to keep ourselves safe. So I'm thinking that, for example, the barring and disclosing service. Yes, we may want everybody at our child's school for there to have been some police record check. But we know that maybe the police aren't great at keeping records, or that these records wouldn't capture a lot of the risk behaviours and risk factors. In actual fact, when we look at the case of Sarah Everard and Wayne Cousins, we see that actually the police aren't even able to monitor their own. The systems that should have barred someone aren't necessarily reliable and did not work in Wayne Cousins' case.
And in the case of CCTV, of a woman's walking down a dark alley at night and invests trust because she sees a CCTV camera, and we know that those systems are often not monitored at all, or the evidence that they collect is never used. It's a false kind of trust. It's a misplaced trust.
It is a misplaced trust that might take people's attention away from their own personal responsibility or gut instinct.
Yeah, that's a very important one. And the idea that it could somehow prevent crime, it won't stop you getting raped and murdered.
No.
It might help in the investigation of your rape and murder.
I happen to think that I would want to build a culture where women feel as safe as men to walk where they like, any time that they want, go where they want. But I think that a misplaced trust in systems, such as the Horizon IT system at the post office, stops people from engaging with the possibility of these systems being just wrong.
Mm. So we'll come back to that Max Frisch quote, that technology is a way of not having to experience the world, and that many technologies stop people from seeing the reality, feeling the reality.
Mm.
They're a comfort cushion that way. Okay, so let's move on to this idea of, do you think that technology is making people able to trust each other more? Are we making a more trusting society or a less trusting society through technology?
It all depends. Trust to do what? Do we trust, for example, people on a dating site to be who they say that they're going to be? Well, maybe not. Do we trust that when we use our contactless card that it will take out of our account the money that we think that is going out of our account and that that's fair and reasonable and secure? Perhaps we put way too much trust in that.
And especially in an environment where increasingly the business model is betrayal. What Cory Doctorow calls enshittification, which is where trust is cultivated deliberately. They spend a fortune on psychologists and PR people to engage you and get you to trust a system with the intent from the outset to betray you for money. I mean, that's becoming a common business model in tech. How do you think people should respond to that?
I think compelling or manipulating someone to use a piece of technology or a digital product
as a trusted system. But if you've only got the choice of using one app from one bank on one model of smartphone, you've got a complete monopoly that's sewing the whole thing up.
Yeah.
Then that's compulsion, effectively. Yeah. Or, for example, schools trying to push Google Chromebooks on children who have their parents and the children have every right not to trust that product.
Mm.
Google are in the business of harvesting data from individuals to sell.
Yeah. Trust can't be compelled. So you might say, I will use this system because I'm given no choice, no freedom, no autonomy. But using a system isn't the same as trusting it. And I'm thinking that actually, then I would be very careful not to trust a system that I was compelled to use. You know, creating some sort of code so that I knew that, yes, this might be monitored, but if I knew that my emails were being monitored, we might agree on some sort of code that meant this isn't safe anymore, let's stop, like, something like...
Well, people do have options. I mean,
we
have encryption.
Yeah.
To stop people snooping on emails. Yeah. But people are increasingly semi-compelled to use trusted systems which are untrustworthy for things that they would have no other option for, such as banking or getting food.
Yeah.
In those kinds of cases where life's basic necessities are being mediated by untrustworthy trusted systems, there are very few options but sabotage. What happened to that smartphone that you were compelled to have by work once?
It was locked in a metal filing cabinet, and I'm aware of my wish to do that annoying bunny ears thing, but I forgot the password.
Forgot the password.
Yeah.
You set it up with the highest level of security possible.
Yeah.
And then you forgot
the password.
How very careless of you.
I know.
You being a non-technical person,
yes,
it's probably an unfair question, but have you any thoughts about how people can build real trustworthiness using technology?
Maybe it's just the capacity to reflect on our habits and how we use technology. One final thought about trust is that I think that trust needs to be earned. So if you're supporting a small person to become an adult, you do it by increments. You do it based on the situation. So, for example, you might trust a child to be able to cross the road safely when you have observed them crossing the road several times and you've seen them look both ways, you've seen that they are very aware of their surroundings, they're becoming more responsible, and you know that there will be a time where they have to cross that road without you holding their hand and without you watching. Mm-hmm. And they will slowly become independent. But trust is essential for independence. But trust is also something to be negotiated, and trust is something to be earned. And I think that what you are getting at is just how untrustworthy the systems that are integrated into all our lives are, that actually these systems are proving themselves time and time and time again to be untrustworthy.
They're not going to get trustworthy, I don't think, because they are more than mediations of what we do in society. They are instruments of power.
Mm.
And it's the abuse of power that we're seeing more and more through technology.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. Great contributions, Kate. Good to have you on the show again.
You're very welcome. And maybe that smartphone just remains in that locked filing cabinet.
You're listening to The Cyber Show.
Closely related to trust, we could also talk about the disappearance of truth. In the age of disinformation and generative AI, knowing who or what to believe is becoming an ever-vanishing resource. But that's such an extensive subject, we ought to leave it for another episode. So instead, in the next segment, Ed is going to be speaking about something that concerns older people more and more these days, the disappearance of people who can help, the disappearance of care. It's almost impossible to speak to a doctor's surgery in the UK these days, when all a person really needs is a 20-second conversation to hear the words, "That's probably all right, come in and see me next week," or to call their bank and hear that, "No, we didn't send that message, definitely do not respond to it, or you're likely to be the victim of a phishing scam." That would add a great deal of assurance and reduce a lot of anxiety. But all you get is hours of call waiting, hold music, and dumb, patronising AI voices designed to frustrate and deflect you. The disappearance of access to care is causing great anxiety in our country today. The analogue telephone systems built after the last war were designed with social cohesion in mind. Like the post office, they became central pillars of a society built on trust and some kind of basic, procedural, technological stability. Rather than making things better, technology today seems to be constantly eroding those standards, because market capitalism demands that if we can replace humans with machines, regardless of whether that makes an improvement, we must, so long as it reduces costs. Let's hear from Ed about systems that help to make us feel safe.
When the world's on fire, what number do you call? It all began on the 10th of November 1935, when five women burned to death in a house fire in central London. A neighbour had tried to call the fire brigade on his home telephone, but had to wait in a queue for his local exchange. And by the time he got through to the operator, it was too late. Incensed, he wrote a letter to the Times which provoked an immediate government inquiry. Ah, those were the days. 2 years later, the first emergency call system in the world was rolled out, Dial 999. A red light would flash at the exchange and your call would be immediately answered. And the rest is history, with many variations like 000 in Australia and 111 in New Zealand. The idea spread around the world and every telephone became a hotline to help. Except, of course, when it isn't. The UK's 999 system is a regulatory requirement for major telco BT, who recently mucked it up and is in trouble. At least it's a uniform countrywide service, unlike the US 911 system, which is barely a system at all but a patchwork of uncoordinated local provisions. The big problem, however, is technology. The 999 system set the blueprint and was brilliantly designed to work with telephones of the day. All phones were powered along copper cables from the exchange, which had battery backup, so everything worked through the power outages. The system was inherently local and universal. You could pick up a phone anywhere and be in contact with your area police, medics, or firefighters in seconds, even if you knew nothing about your location. Almost none of this is true today. What remains of plain copper cable telephone systems is being phased out in favour of VoIP or mobile, each dependent on an infrastructure that goes out when the light does. You no longer call from a fixed geographic point with a known number, but are at mercy of a skew of GIS systems that may or may not work for you. So, if you come across five women burning to death these days, and if you have mobile coverage for your operator, you'll get through, but you might not be able to tell them where you are. This is symptomatic of an even bigger picture, where we know the value of instant reliable emergency communication, but the evolution of technology with no coordination has produced a huge tangle of random systems. You may have an emergency network on broadcast radio and TV, but everyone's on Netflix. Or you may use the cell broadcast system. Good luck with that. There are innumerable separate systems for aircraft and shipping, many of which are prone to false alarms and none of which provide redundancy for the others. So it's an expensive, unholy shambles, and when things really go wrong and a natural disaster knocks out all the local infrastructure, you have to wait for the local radio hams to dig themselves out from their cellars and wire things up again. We can do better. Rethinking the network. Let's go back to 1935 and ask what it is they wanted. A universal system with a robust infrastructure that's extremely simple to use and puts people in immediate contact with those who can help. Digital wireless can provide universal connectivity. You can go anywhere in the world and get connected through cellular or Wi-Fi, or satellite. Satellite is the right answer. Satellites are fabulous for this. They don't blow over in a hurricane, they don't go out when the local power plant goes bang, and if you can see the sky, you're good to go. As climate change-driven weather events make life on the ground even more precarious, this is a system that's ready to cope. Aviation and maritime people know this, which is why they use satellites. Very big, expensive satellites with a mess of different systems, to be sure, but that's because that's all there was back then. Not so now. Make it a condition of giving Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and whoever they include emergency universal comms on their satellite constellations to get permission to fly, and we're good. Emergency call services are very low bandwidth, which is very cheap, very power frugal, and very reliable to add to high bandwidth satellites and low cost devices on the ground. Because we're talking universal standards here, we can bake in solid location detection that we know will work. You can build the user bits into standalone devices, or as part of a mobile phone, as long as it's a simple one-button activation. Though there is a downside. Pocket dialing and kids mucking about are already the bane of emergency responders. Fixing this at scale is going to take psychology, UI smarts, and very careful filter designing at the call centre. But they did all that for 999 in the 30s, we can do it in 2023. Yet, think of the benefits of a proper universal service. The device can know what languages the user can speak, so the system can route through to appropriate call handlers immediately. It can be adapted for disabilities, special needs, or any environmental situation. The backend system, armed with known good location data, can immediately provide the responder, no matter where they are in the world, with a menu of emergency services. The same system can and should work in reverse, carrying vital information about local dangers or precautions. You want the thing to be used. One of the reasons cell broadcast emergency systems don't work is that they're never used enough to be reliable. The old 999 worked because it was based on a universal object in daily use. As for the cost, over time, as existing emergency services age into expensive obsolescence, the way forward will be to migrate onto this new system, made cheap through scale and reliable through use. One world, one help button. Let's think big. The letter to the Times is on its way.
Okay, now let's talk about the disappearing netizen. What's a netizen? Well, that's an old-fashioned word that we used to use to mean a citizen of the internet. I don't know why I chose that word today, because we've long since moved on from netizens to being cattle in giant corporate ranches. But not only is the fake internet or the dead internet becoming a reality, so are the fake inhabitants of it. In a recent episode, we heard from Helen and our guest Mercy talking about fake women in tech, and that so few women were prepared to participate in conferences because they couldn't be authentic, they couldn't say what they like and what they really thought, to just be a woman, that organisers started replacing women with fake avatars AI-generated images, voices and legends of non-existent females to create the illusion of equality. Have a listen to this short clip of the late Rick Roderick, philosopher of human values, talking about why power invents fake opposition, and think maybe about the so-called elections happening in Russia today. Why do they even bother going through the theatre of a fake election? There is, after all, no opposition.
That's why the most powerful anti-war movement America could have now would be for the last few of us that are against the war to disappear completely so that it looks like those polls were 100%. And many of my friends have started throwing off the poll numbers and joining the pro-demonstrators, because the worst statement we can make about our democracy is to be unanimously for something which will make itself evident it's no democracy. So the most radical thing in our culture, struggles will have to become more sophisticated. Instead of fighting Bush, maybe the best way to fight him is to agree with him. Say, hell yes, bomb them all and get right with them. Talk all of your wildest friends into it. Say, yeah, because once 100%, that's saturation. No opposition, Bush will go. What'll we do for a TV spot? They'll have to start hiring the CIA to go out and demonstrate. They would. I mean, presumably, there's no opposition. That's what we used to say we were a democracy, was the opposition. So there'll be all kinds of new strategies. And I have not yet given up on that last remaining spots of clarity that are around in the world.
So maybe in a fake technological world, on fake social media, where truth, trust, discoverability, authenticity, and all our seriousness and meaning are disappearing, the smartest thing to do is to disappear yourself. The final disappearance today comes to us in the form of a musical poem by our regular Dr. Kate Brown. For better or worse, the internet seems to be something we're stuck with. But how much we're stuck with it is still up to us. I'll quote from Solomon in Ecclesiastes, who said, "I have seen under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favour to the learned, but time and chance happen to them all." We once had Betamax, which was better, but instead we got VHS because that was cheaper. We didn't get the internet that we could have, that we should have. We got this one. And we've become dependent upon it. Dependency is a strange thing. We fear staying and we fear leaving. As that line from the Clash song goes, "If I stay, there will be trouble, but if I go, there will be double." Not only do we worry about some technologies going and leaving us alone, we worry about them staying, becoming unavoidable and overwhelming burdens upon us. As generative AI content swamps the network and younger people turn away from more personal platforms like Facebook in favour of algorithmic digital candy like TikTok, perhaps one of the more welcome and long overdue disappearances is the demise of social media itself, of the endless quest for likes, of the pouting selfies, on the perfect beach, in front of the perfect sunset. Because, hell, you can just ask your phone to create that now, and nobody can tell the difference. So, where will we find ourselves and find each other in the coming years? Here's where we won't find us.
Don't find me on Facebook. Let's keep things private. I will not update my status. In person, IRL. Give me analog, unpixelated, skin against skin. A glance, a sigh, a smell and sound beyond a prying eye. Give me room to feel a breath on my skin. Don't find me on Facebook. do not like my posts or stalk my exes. There are times I want to be forgotten. No permanent record of my bad poetry, my mistakes and misjudgments. Do not cancel me. Don't find me on Facebook. Find me a private space offline, unmoderated, speakeasy. Use email if you want to speak to me. When we are apart, be secure, private, not secret, not to be invaded. Don't find me. Do not sell my data. I am not for sale, nor to be analysed. Leave me, undigitalised and unpixelated. Don't find me.
Cybershow on www.cybershow.uk. The Cyber Show.